And I'm Ashley.
And this we're is Celebrity Memoir Book Club.
This is
Sing
or
it,
we are.
Sister.
This is or we are.
This is.
All right. I guess first things up, our new thing is to thank the people who reviewed us and then to absolutely demolish the haters. So I love Fagsy. I mean, you should be canceled and sent to hell. I love Fagsy says, get to the point. Banter is way too long in the beginning.
I thought you were saying that you loved them. And I was like, we don't love them. They gave us a bad review.
No, their name is I Love Fagsy. Yeah, that's the fucking podcast. And I cannot get it through your twerpy, dumb little worm for brain skulls that if you don't like it, we literally don't owe you anything. If anything, you owe us something because we went into debt to make this podcast for you. If you don't want to listen, don't fucking listen. It's not my dream to sit here and regurgitate bullshit facts about people I hate. That is these celebrities. It's my job to do, okay, honestly, it is my job to do people's like expenses and stuff. I'm not getting paid for this at all. But it's like, if you don't like it, then don't listen. There's actually other celebrity memoir book clubs that you could like download and listen. Like, we don't owe you anything. Don't
also,
listen if you hate it. I hate you.
Can I say something that I take issue with is you saying that this person has worms for brains, because as a diehard squirmy worm, a bookworm for the centuries, I think having a worm brain is a good thing. And you, ma'am, have snails for brains.
Yeah. Or boy.
Or sir.
If you're new here, look, I'm not normally this angry. Yes, I am. I'm pretty angry all the time. But I cannot express it hard enough. If you're here just to talk about the book, either roll forward or leave. That's not our shtick. It'll never be our shtick. We don't need to do it.
We don't like, speak linearly or circularly.
We barely speak at all. We're mostly mumbly-gumbling.
Anyway, on from that, because we don't need to give more attention to the snail brain haters.
Don't waste your time. If you don't want to hear two BFFs just chit-chat and laugh and talk about the hardships of life, then get out of here.
Okay, so a shout-out to Nesquik101.
Angel. And Samantha Sweetheart.
Samantha Sweetheart, fun name. No thanks to Ashley Lanchy, except for the fact that saying the reason you don't like us is because we hate short people is very funny to me. Because, my God, I do not like short people.
Okay, also, it turns out there's secret reviews that we've never seen before that only show up on my boyfriend's phone for some reason. And so to 8KVL, thank you for thinking we're a great podcast. You literally said, could you do Demi Moore's memoir next, and we are. So
yeah, next week, baby, stay tuned.
And then Sarah Jane G7, the only complaint is there aren't more episodes. We're working on it right now. Thank you so much for listening. And
same with the previous one.
And then
stay tuned.
Mickey speaks the truth. That's my boyfriend. Thank you, baby. I love you.
Mickey.
That's like what his parents call him. They call him Mickey.
That's cute.
Yeah. Anyway, Ashley, how was your week?
Okay.
On to the part that the people hate, but we don't care because we have to stay true to ourselves. Sorry, we're not sellouts.
I think the snails for brains hate it and the worms for brains love it.
And we love worms. Squirmy wormies.
Anyway.
Ashley, how's your week? Did anything unexpected happen? Did you get any texts from people you didn't see coming?
Okay, so if you would like to ask me to title my memoir, I would call it Boo. Bitch, I'm a ghost.
Love a TikTok reference.
Which is a TikTok reference for the TikTok listeners. Also, it is a reference to the fact that a prominent character of my past texted me out of the blue on Friday night. And as much as I had a very uneventful week. And then all of a sudden, a text that shook me like lightning, baby. I got a text from Matthew, who longtime listeners will know is my ex-boyfriend. We had a, some would say, tumultuous relationship that is heavily chronicled on our previous podcast, We're in a Fight with Claire and Ashley. And in September, which you can learn from listening to our Patreon, we stopped speaking forever. We broke up in August, and in September, we made the decision to never speak again. And by we made the decision, I mean he told me that he could never speak to me again. And much like a liar, he did.
I believe I said
me.
It back when I said, if Matt is anything, he is a deeply unself-aware hypocrite.
Yeah, and I wish the best for him, but my God, getting a text from him like that, I honestly thought it was going to be mean, and it was very nice. It was just like about how he misses me and stuff, and I miss him, like, knowing what's up with him, it really weirds me out that I just, like, don't know where he is or what he's doing or what he's up to or anything. If you guys want more details than that, subscribe to the Patreon.
Baby. Also, Mac actually had a prediction for what he thinks will happen next. And I would love to put it on the Patreon and see if it comes true.
Okay. I'm very curious because this is something that I also don't know. I'm also going to have to subscribe to the Patreon to find this out. Anyway. So, yeah. I will say getting that text from him really shook me up. Shook my little, rattled my little bones.
Would you read the text on the Patreon?
I was thinking that what if we did do a dramatic reading of it?
Because I haven't heard it either and I kept wanting to ask. This is how sick my brain is. I thought it was too much of like a boundary crossing to ask if I could read the text he sent you. But for some reason, I don't think it's inappropriate for me to ask you to read it aloud for $5.
Okay, you guys, I will do a dramatic reading of it on the Patreon. And it isn't bad. It's just something that it's very emotional. He loves emotions when he's having them, not when I'm having them. And, you know, I'm excited to see. I honestly haven't decided if I'm going to respond. Maybe we'll put a poll on the Patreon. Should I respond yes or no? And yeah, that is about the summation of my week. Claire, how's yours?
I would say this chapter in my memoir would actually get cut. So I'd say this is like, I just had a genuinely uneventful week. Basically, we're back home working from home with my office. I guess they decided 200,000 corona cases a day was enough for me to be a receptionist from home. Not a lot happened. As many of you know, I don't know if actually any of you know, I'm obsessed with trying to find a mid-century modern dresser that I buy at auction so that it's cheap. I do think,
how would they not know? It's all you talk about.
Once again, I was beat at auction for the dresser that I've now decided is actually the dresser of my dreams. I like really thought it would be at first I was like, I don't think anybody even wants this. And I was like, do I have the worst taste? Does this dresser suck? It's so ugly that nobody even wants it, I guess. And then it went for the most expensive price I've seen so far on this website. And I was just like, I wake up every day and when the light comes through the window, I think that was the dresser I needed. It was, for those of you who want to know, it was a Johnson Carper fashion trend dresser with like white knobs in the middle and then kind of like it was like a little bit wavy on the side. Anyway,
sure.
It came with a mirror. I'm like really sad about it. I will say the only funny thing that happened is last night I was in a really weird mood. And so I sometimes just like to make myself cry. And Mac is really good to me, so it's hard to like get him into a spot where he makes me cry. So I have to kind of like finagle it with impossible questions that there are no good answers to.
Classic.
So last night's how do I make myself cry was I asked Mac if he fell out of love with me. If one day he woke up and wasn't in love with me anymore, how long would it go on for before he would end our relationship?
I still think that he misunderstood the question.
And so he said, he's like, so you're saying like I woke up and just wasn't feeling it? Like how long would I just like absolutely not feel it? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I guess like a month. And I was like, a month? A month? I was like, I did not like my ex-boyfriend for 1 minute and we dated for 4 years. So
I was going to say I've had I've eaten something weird and gotten a month long tummy ache.
A month. Like that is, I've dated guys that I'm not even in relationships with for a month that I didn't even like. And I just kept texting him for a month.
Same. That's why I'm really proud of my new thing where I've not been dating people that I don't like.
I'm really proud of you too.
I have a date tonight that I don't think I like.
Well, there's only one way to know. As long as you don't do it for a month. But I don't know. That made me so sad because I was like, well, would you tell me so I could try to turn it around? And I was like, how long would it take for you to tell me that you weren't feeling things? He's like, I guess like a week. And I was like, okay, so if one day you wake up and don't love me, you'll give it 7 days, and if you still don't love me, I have 3 weeks to turn the ship around. And then I started crying and he's like, why are you crying? And I'm like, I just feel like I kind of assume me and Mac will get married.
I think that's safe to assume.
And I'm
unless
like,
of course there's one rough month.
I was like, oh my God, if he woke up tomorrow morning and didn't love me, like he would move out before our couch was sent. Like he would move out before we got our couch delivered.
I actually don't think that he would, because I do think he would see what a lurch he was leaving you in rent wise, and he would live in the office and you would live in the bedroom and you guys would probably still live together for 2 to 3 months until you figured out a fair situation.
You think, wait, who do you think would get the office?
I think he would live in the office and you would live in the bedroom. I think
he would get the big bedroom because he'd be paying more.
Yeah, but I think that, like, emotionally, you would get the big bedroom. Like, I think if he's, like, leaving you, he would say, I'll sleep in the office.
Wouldn't that be so funny if he, like, got a beanbag as his bed so that he could keep his giant desk for his new PC? He was just sleeping on a beanbag like a dog. So that he had room for his PC because that bedroom is small. Anyway, but my point was, as I explained to him, I was like, if we got married and said we have 70 years left together, I just feel like in the course of 70 years, I can't have one bad month where I'm acting like a moody little bitch.
I also think that now that you've added, this is what I'm saying, is I don't think he understood the question, because like once you add other life events into the situation, like I think that in the first year of your relationship, a month makes total sense. I think now that you guys live together, a month is a little steep. I think once you're married,
you get like a year, right?
I think you get like at least a year, unless you're in like a pretty critical year where you need to like get a new husband and have a baby quick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if you were like 32 and decided you weren't feeling it anymore, like that's a pretty important year.
I feel like if you have kids, you try for at least 3 years to fake it, unless they like absolutely like if you.
But
both,
if you don't have kids yet and you're like 32 and not really feeling
it. Yeah, if you're like, if you don't think this is going anywhere, we have to
like cut it, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you're like 41, give it a little time. Like what's the difference between being 41 and 43 anyway?
Okay, and then the other thing I did that hurt my feelings.
The other thing you did that hurt your own feelings?
That's my move. Okay. So I like to make my hurt my own feel. I like to joke and joke and joke and then just start to cry because the joke's not funny anymore. It just hurts me.
You're sick.
As I asked him, I was like, you would never cheat on me. And he was like, never. And I believe that. He would never cheat on me. And
I also believe that.
But I was like, what would you say is a contributing factor to that? And he was like, I don't know, because that's a shitty thing to do. And I was like, yeah, but like, do you think you never cheat on me because you love me or because it's in your personality or because it's just like a lot of work to leave the house? And he was like, all of those answers. And I was like, well, in what order? And he was like, and he goes, 1, 2, 3. And I go, no. And he's like, what do you mean no? And I was like, well, would you ever cheat on anyone? And he was like, no. And I was like, exactly. Mm-mm. So reason number one is it's just not your personality. So that has nothing to do with me. That's an all you thing. And he was just like, okay, I guess you're right, Claire. He's like, I guess I wouldn't cheat on anybody. And I was like, so first and foremost, it's who you are. Secondly, because you love me. And he was just like, I don't know what to do.
I do think you're backing him into a weird corner. And the more times per month you do this, the sooner that month is going to come to you.
Well, what would you rather? Would you rather somebody who's cheated on everybody but you or somebody?
Are you saying would I rather date anybody? You or Mac?
Yeah.
I would rather someone who doesn't cheat on anybody, but I would be happy either way not getting cheated on.
See, I almost think I'd rather me.
I know you would. That's why you keep asking this question.
I'm like, don't you think it's romantic that I've never treated anyone but you good? It means I really love you.
Yeah, but that also means he really loves you.
I don't see that.
He's never built a computer in someone else's
apartment
with a girlfriend that would be hard to move.
That's true. So I guess
literally built the thing he loves most into his house with you, the thing he loves second most.
Wow, that's really true when you think about it like that.
He wanted to attach you guys so that together he could love you two more than anything in the world.
I wish I was that PC. I wish PC stood for Pretty Claire.
The thing's Pretty Claire. And you were Regular Claire.
Oh my God, then it really is like I married my dad.
I would so much rather he cheat on you
than call his computer Pretty Claire. It's like Claire, but I love it.
It's like Claire, but it never asks the hard questions.
You guys, we did something extracurricular this week.
Even more than just reading books, we've also watched TV.
This week, for educational purposes, we got very high, legal in New Jersey.
We watched Glitter.
Which you may know as
Hashtag Justice for Glitter.
Our overall review is that if Mariah Carey had not tried to like pawn it off as a good film, it would have been a cult classic.
I really think it really gave me like PG-13 Showgirls vibes. Like the vibe with just like how weirdly like bright and 80s-esque it was supposed, like I did not understand until halfway through the movie when one of the characters literally said it's the 80s, that it was supposed to be the 80s. But It just had that like weird.
How could you not know it was the 80s when she had a side ponytail the whole time?
I thought that that was just like a bad choice.
And it was.
I've seen people do side ponytails in the 90s.
Also, like, I've seen people not do side ponytails in the 80s. And I exactly. think they should have not done a side ponytail. We do want to say nice things first. Nice. She things? Is so beautiful in it.
Whenever she's standing perfectly still, Claire and I would say to each other, she's so beautiful.
I don't know why, really, but there's something very radiant. She, like, does have very beautiful skin, and she's very radiant. And she has this pose that she thinks is acting where she just opens her eyes really wide and is listening attentively.
And then she nods, and she, like, says a breathy yes or no.
The movie itself isn't honestly terrible. There's, like, okay, are we allowed to do spoilers? It came out in 2001.
Yeah.
Somebody, like, straight up gets shot at the end. I don't know. Like, there's no reason not to like it. It's as good as a J-Lo movie.
Which J-Lo movie? Because it's also just like fuzzy. It's like the girl who shot Bitchness is me and Claire's failed web series shot it. Like it is.
There like, is something where like you can tell nobody knew what it was. It seems like they thought it could be a serious movie and then they wanted it to be a rom-com and then somebody dies and then I don't really know what it was supposed to be, but it wasn't the worst thing I'd ever seen.
I've definitely seen worse movies.
I watched The Holiday twice this season and I would say The Holiday is worse.
And yeah, once again, I think, and, like, the way it's just so, it's very campy. It's very just, like, silly and weird and nonsensical. Like, the way things move, the timeline is baffling. And I just think that if she had been, like, this was, like, a silly, weird project that I put way too much effort into, oops, everyone would have been, like, genius.
I will say, I can confidently say now, though, that she was not a good actress in it. She wasn't bad. But she wasn't good. She was a singer who was doing the movie. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, she was not good.
She was no worse than I'm sure Maddie Ziegler will be in as an autistic person.
It's really funny because thinking about it now. Okay, so my dad has this theory. I don't know if you guys have seen Cheaper by the Dozen. But my dad has this theory that Hilary Duff was like written into the movie. That like basically they obviously had 12. I used to yell at him and say she couldn't have been written into the movie. It's called Cheaper by the Dozen. They had to have had 12 kids. They couldn't have just added a 12th kid. It wasn't going to be cheaper by the 11. And but
that would
he
be
said,
so funny.
But then he would always say that, no, her character, like, they probably didn't think they'd cast such a big fish for this random middle sister. And so as soon as they landed Hilary Duff, they were like, we need to add more lines to have her on screen more because the kids will love it, which he was right. I loved every second of it. But also her lines had nothing to do with anything that was ever happening in the movie. They were very definitely added in. With Mariah's character, I want to say the opposite. I think that they had a lot cut out. Her character literally does just stand there with her eyes wide in the corner while her boyfriend and the record execs and her friends, all of them do most of the talking. She's really just kind of either singing or standing. Yeah. And I think that they probably tried to have her act more and it didn't work.
Yeah, she's a great singer, though.
Like the amount of times that her boyfriend would just like carry, like just say a lot of stuff and then she would say, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's like her whole vibe. Yeah. But all in all, worth a watch. Didn't need to cause a breakdown.
Yeah, so we've definitely gotten a lot of comments on TikTok about the fact that she was almost definitely bipolar as hell, which would make sense because she is a very talented artist and they're all mentally ill.
You know who else was bipolar?
Kanye?
Demi Moore's mom.
Oh.
Anyway, you guys, I'm so excited to do our final installment of the Mariah series.
Wait, no, so what I was saying is that people are saying that her, like, big ol', like, all that TRL stuff and the throwing plates at her mom's house and, like, all that was, like, that tail end of a manic episode.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Oh my god, my heart goes out to her.
Me too.
I hope she like got the help she needs. We love her
a lot.
Which is why
we're talking about her for a third time.
We're so excited to bring our guest. She's a hilarious comedian. She's passed at the Comedy Cellar.
You've seen her on Comedy Central this week at the Cellar.
Oh my god, give it up for Brittany Carney.
Brittany, just like right off the bat, what were your thoughts before you even cracked this book? What were your thoughts on Mariah?
Okay, I was really honored to be asked for this book specifically because I have warm childhood associations with the myth or legend of Mariah Carey because I have vivid memories of dancing around to All I Want for Christmas with my mom during Christmas.
Like, beautiful.
I don't think I have so many concrete memories of when I was like about four, but I have one, which is that my parents had installed a like cardboard jungle gym thing in our living room, and I was on it and holding hands with my mom dancing to this song. And every Christmas we listened to this album at some point. So I was really excited because I feel emotionally connected to Mariah Carey, but also cynical about the idea of this book, because I was like, well, what, you know what I was thinking of? Like Glitter.
Yeah.
I was thinking,
we just watched it this week.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is something.
I don't think it's as bad as it needed to be, but she, I think for it to have soared, we think she should have let go of the idea it was a great film and let it just be like a silly.
And like be kind of self-aware about it.
Yeah, just have it be like what it, I think it was perfect for teenagers who wanted to feel serious. It was kind of like,
oh, yeah.
Do you know what? I felt like it was something you could have watched the weekend before you watched Fight Club, where you're like, the music industry is dirty.
So, right, I had this sort of like childhood association with her. Is this like uniquely talented person and like legendary, and then there was that kind of like wacky TRL sort of phase, right? Which actually now I'm kind of into that. Like I love okay, so she, like, even stylistically, it's like the way that she began to dress when she got older and the way that she got kind of like sillier or something.
Yeah,
I actually appreciate it right now a lot.
Yeah,
she loves making sure in this book she really like needs people to know that she's funny.
Right. Yeah.
And that she has a sense of humor that about does stuff come across, but I was gonna say, like, with the TRL and with all that stuff, part of me thinks it would have been different in this current age of being able to connect with your fans whenever you want, because she did also like pioneer that whole like writing letters to her fans on her website situation. Really connecting directly with people pre-social media. But if it had been during the age of social media, you know, she wouldn't have needed to crash TRL and have Carson involved and like have this whole, she could have like orchestrated her own like weird little Instagram live. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's so true. And have such an unwavering fan base through Instagram live that would check in all the time.
Right. She didn't need to rely on the industry to create this thing that she needed.
Right.
That they were not doing at the time.
Also, we were just saying people have come out and said she's been bipolar since diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
And it does feel like, I mean, I don't think we're perfect as a society yet, but it seems like we're a little bit closer to being forgiving of people's mental health issues.
That was totally my next thought, because it's like, now I think people would be more sensitive about making fun of her, like whether it's about mental health ableism or just like misogyny.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that like the reaction were she to go through that now would be different.
Totally. I mean, yeah, people are so much more conscious now of, I mean, also we're just like not getting celebrity breakdowns in the same way because we're giving celebrities, I think, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess we'll get like a new era of memoirs in a couple of years and find out for sure. I kind of want to believe, based on how many celebrities like kind of disappear for a year or so, that we're like letting people have breaks.
Right. Like maybe even the Britney buzzing head thing would have been different now.
Yeah. I think, well, if you look at Selena Gomez, they really got her out of the public eye.
I was going to say, I think Selena Gomez, the fact that we do not see her for 8 months at a time is proof that we're getting there.
Yeah. Or like Amanda Bynes.
Oh, God.
Well, that's a whole other thing, because she.
That's a funny, exact case study of the opposite of what we're saying, where. Yeah. Twitter really did not help her conceal her mental illness.
Oh, damn.
Do you remember when she was tweeting that crazy stuff? She was like, I know that I'm going to, not allowed to say that anymore, but whatever. When she was like, Drake, I want Drake to murder my pussy.
Yeah.
What?
She said vagina.
She said vagina. Sorry. That's fine, I guess. she said, I want Drake to murder my vagina.
Yep.
On Twitter.
That's hilarious.
And really people got really mad. And then every time someone would tweet at her being like, you need to get help, she would be like, you're so ugly. And then like other celebrities would speak out about her, not even honestly from what I know about entertainment journalism, not in any way out of turn, but you know they only play the soundbite, so like I'm sure a journalist was saying, what do you think about what's going on with Amanda Bynes? And then a celebrity would say like, I really hope she gets help. And then she would tweet, so and so is ugly.
I'm gonna adopt that. Next, I was at a show last night where nobody laughed at any of my jokes, and I wish I just looked them all in the face and said, "What's your name, Eric? Eric, you're ugly."
I think there's something so cutting and funny about that. Even
it's so funny. I mean, that's my theory, is like using dramatic insults, I think, doesn't land. And I think when you really dumb it down and say, like, literally, like, "Are you dumb?" That's the meanest thing you could say to someone. Like, "You're ugly. You're dumb."
Yeah.
It cuts. Okay, there's a reason we have those words, and they're to hurt.
And that's what makes people like get thrown off, right? They're like, yeah.
Well, because what can you say? No, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, Mariah.
Mariah, I really love Mariah Carey, and yeah, so I feel like there was this phase of her, her celebrityhood that I like. Either was like getting into that zeitgeist of like, oh, what's going on with Mariah, like, ugh. But now actually as a more elevated adult, mm-hmm. I'm like really into her vibe. You know that song that's like it's like a more recent song but like in the past 10 years, it's like she like mentions YouTube in it.
Is it like Touch My Body?
Touch My Body. And yes. Like, I think Nick Cannon is in the music video. No,
I think she wanted him to
She was with him, she wanted him to be, but it was Jack McBryer from 30
yes,
Rock.
Yes.
How funny is that? I mean, that really is funny. So funny.
Okay, so that song, it's like kind of funny and like a bit self-aware and silly.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
that's such a funny music video. He's like chasing her around with a Nerf gun.
I feel like she's really also come into her like older body as well.
Yeah, and she feels
like
very sensual.
It's like so sensual, like lots of tits and curves, yeah. And it's like really lovely.
She's very beautiful. Yeah. She's just so hot. And she also is. Oh yeah, what I was gonna say about All I Want for Christmas, because obviously it's Christmas time again, and so it's popping up everywhere, and every year it's like one of those Christmas songs. I mean, I love Christmas music as a Jewish person. I like get high on Christmas cheer. I fucking love it. And the first, we talked about this a lot when we used to talk about Britney Spears, is that like it really is the first couple notes of a song that when the first couple notes like smack you in the face, it is like a recipe for a song that just goes to the next level. And that song, you hear the first two notes and you're like, this is Christmas cheer straight to the veins, and I love it. Like,
yeah. And you know what's so sweet is like she wrote it for that. She like literally wrote that song, and she talks about it in the book. She was with her two gay uncles.
I want to love Christmas.
It was her only happy childhood memory, was that she had these uncles who had a good Christmas. And she was like, I specifically wrote it with like a pared down piano with that child kind of like dingy Schroeder from Peanuts type of piano, so that people would feel that homey nostalgia. And the fact that that's exactly what she was able to create for you, like, I really am blown away by the genius of her ability to create an emotion and a memory. And like the fact that she did want to change touch people with that song the exact way it touched you,
right?
And here you are 20 years later being like, I remember at 4 years old this song stuck out more than any of my previous memories to that moment.
And that's it. I actually have several thoughts, threefold maybe, my reaction to this. One is that that passage really struck me because it was so interesting that she had this like one experience of a cozy Christmas, and that's what inspired that song. And I sometimes think, I'm like, maybe just as an adult these days, like I'll like, or like even in just with friends or like dating, and you like ask people about their families and their experiences, is learning about how other people's holiday vibes are. And I realized that I feel very fortunate in my particular family's experience of Christmas, whatever that means, and like that it was cozy or is sort of cozy. And also referencing Schroeder, that was really cute and nostalgic, and that really struck me. And then the second thing I want to say is that I had a spiritual experience related to that passage, because literally I was in Black Swan, which is it's like a bar that's like a British pub, and I was sitting in there reading the book, and I was reading that chapter when the song came on.
Oh my God.
That was this weekend.
Mariah Carey summoned it.
She summoned it. It felt like, in relation to Love Actually, dare I say, Love Actually cheapened that song, maybe for
it
me.
It might have.
Can I say, I like have a very controversial take on Love Actually, which is, I'm always like, Love Actually, that's actually not love. I think that movie has nothing to do with love.
No.
Not one of those relationships. They have 92 relationships in that film, and not one of them is recognizable to me as a healthy relationship. They're like, I fell in love with my non-English speaking maid. I'm a child with a crush. Or I'm like, I cheat. I'm like, none of these people are
or
love.
The
I'm
Prime Minister.
President who's sexually assaulting an intern. What kind of Monica bullshit?
Yeah.
Okay. And well, it's a very cute movie with a lot of British Jewish people that I hold dear.
I know that this is not popular, but I really do think that that movie...
I think it's very popular to not takes. Like that movie. But I do like the movie, but I do get that it sucks.
But I still... I feel like I understand both of your takes on this, like emotionally and politically. And I think that, okay, so that song becomes a
separate
big,
the art from the artist is what I'm saying. And the artist is crime and the art is hominess.
Yeah. And I think that, okay, so Love Actually uses that song as part of its like big climax moment. And like, I think that when it came out and I was younger, it was like, wow, this is like, a cute Christmas movie. I think now, maybe it's just because I've seen it so many times, and I always just think of that like little girl and that scene, which wouldn't happen anymore or if ever, which is like the boy runs through security in the airport.
Through the airport. Yeah. My God, they would have been like, they're training the terrorists young.
And I can't. Yeah, I know. Oh my god. And I can't disassociate now the song from that scene sometimes, but yeah. But the cool thing, so my point is like, it felt cinematic. I was in this bar this weekend and reading that part and the song came on and I was like, what the fuck? It just felt like I was in a movie, like a B, like a C list,
like a Hallmark Christmas movie. We were like reading in the bar and the song comes on and then you like, look up and you're like long lost love across the bar.
Yeah, you're home. Oh my God, you go home for Christmas from your big New York City hustle bustle comedian life and you're
it's like a townie guy. Yeah.
Because nobody there understands how important you are and you just want to get back to your boyfriend who's in finance and then there he is, your middle school crush. He runs a farm now, but he looks handsome as ever and what comes across the radio but your favorite Christmas song.
And he says, leave your Peloton and come live with me.
And there's like really manufactured snow outside
of the room. And then somebody slips and it's comedic. You're brought back to the scene and all of a sudden you both rush and save this person.
Oh my God, let's make the movie. Wow. I would love it.
What is it called?
It's called All I Want for Christmas.
No, it's called All I Want for Britmas. The Brittany Carney Christmas.
That would be like a really tragic, like if my career goes anywhere, like 20 years after I become irrelevant, like my.
Well, like oh my God. And not only because 20 years after you're irrelevant, you'd be allowed to play like the dead grandma. They'd be like, I'm sorry, are you over 40? You could play a skeleton who comes back to haunt the hot young people.
A girl can dream. So those are my three thoughts basically about, well, that song is that I had this moment.
I also agree that. I love the movie, but I don't like that scene in the movie because I hate when children sing.
Me too. I don't like her that whole scene where she... Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because it's
and
like annoying.
And then she sings with like kind
singing.
Of a grown-up-y voice, and I'm just like
who
I don't
are you?
Like this.
Yeah. But and then I think it's like hokey that it's like... But I guess a lot of warm holiday movies like... end at like a school concert where they're like, oh, we're also the prime minister is here. There's
of course. Could you imagine if you were at a school concert and Trump showed up? He would stop the show.
For a few years living in D.C., I worked at the American History Smithsonian Museum, but like in this like children's space. Mm-hmm. And one day Ivanka came with her kid and her kid's friend. And it was this whole to-do. This must have been in 2017.
Oh, so he was like in office.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And what happened is that they had to close down like that wing of the museum and Secret Service were there and then a bunch of just like other moms and caretakers who were like bringing their kid to this play space in the museum had to leave. And it was really surreal because it was like the first Trump and the only since then, even living in DC, like the only Trump that I've like encountered, but I had to like greet Ivanka
That's
Trump
so
and I was
crazy.
Wearing
I love
this like
that
green
she,
apron
like, prevented other children from having learning. A playful education.
Right, and it was that's literally what happened. That's which what seems on brand.
Do you want to hear something crazy? When my mom moved to New York City in the 80s, her first job was like working at the Met in the gift shop or something teaching art lessons, and she taught one of the Trump brothers.
Wow.
So like that is surreal. I mean, for dumbass people, they certainly spend a lot of time at museums. She said he was like brain dead. It literally was like I don't know.
Okay, but that's cool because speaking of like New York in the 80s, like that's so I didn't think about Mariah Carey's history in New York as a child.
Me either.
She's a New York girl and I love that because I relate to that a lot where I'm from Hoboken and
oh, okay. Okay, cool.
So for people who don't know, Hoboken's literally right across the river from Manhattan. Like, I looked into it. In my whole life, I always felt like I was so close to success, but, like, not there. You know what right. I mean? And, my fantasy would be to, like, live the successful New York City life where I could have enough property to have a child here, which feels impossible. But I'm, sure, like, right. I really related to that in Mariah, that she came to New York and she, like, has her penthouse in New York still. And this is where she's – I love a New York yeah. City-based yeah. celebrity. I think they're all in L.A., but I like it when they're in New York.
It's Me really too. Fascinating.
I mean, all the celebrities who stay in New York are so much cooler and more low-key yes. than the ones who –
Yeah.
Like, live in LA and then feel the need to, like, buy an estate in, like, Wyoming because that is they're like, escape. We have to get out of LA sometimes. Whereas, like, the Manhattan celebrities are just like, I'm a Manhattan celebrity. And, like, sometimes I go to the Hamptons or whatever. But, like,
there's just the truth about, I mean, I've
like,
seen
like
yeah.
Katie Holmes is always just like bopping
oh, she's around. Right.
Yeah.
Or, like, even Erykah Badu, I just think, like, has a house in Bed-Stuy and apparently is oh, just so kind cool. of like around.
My God.
Or,
I bet you it's the most incredible house.
I'm sure it's
I
so
bet you it's, like, the
cool.
dopest,
sexy in
most
there.
Beautifully like, decorated brownstone with, like, such cool art.
Exactly. That's my
I bet
image.
You there's a banister that would like ruin my life. Yeah. It's so cool.
And like interesting masks on the wall.
Yes. Oh my God. Like a plant, like a 700-year-old plant what? Somehow coming out of a vase that yeah. I would just be like, well, this needs to be in a this like, needs to be in a museum with
yeah.
a Trump.
Yeah.
For the Trumps to okay. enjoy.
Yeah, so I thought something that was really interesting to me was like her talking about her relationship with different New York neighborhoods and even Brooklyn Heights.
Yeah.
And I remember she said something about how it's like in the 50s, it was like bohemian Brooklyn Heights. But then what was it, the 70s, which is when she was a child there, it was like if any place would be more forgiving for a mixed family, it would have been Brooklyn Heights at this time.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so interesting because also like as just somebody who's only lived in the city for 2 years, almost is like my association with Brooklyn Heights is just like a pretty corporate, like
yeah,
fairly personalityless white
yeah.
pocket
it's like
of Brooklyn.
Very fancy now. It's, yeah, it's just it feels buttoned up. It feels like a buttoned up. It feels like a set of Brooklyn. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Right.
They have a lot of keels. To me, they're keels. They're
it's
keels,
a lot of keels
in a brick. Facing mortar shop.
But like totally. The outside is beautiful, but it's like so clean that you're just like, this doesn't feel like a real, like it
no,
feels
it doesn't.
Like where you would film something, like real New York, but then like,
but it's not,
they
right.
would call cut.
Right. It feels like Northern Virginia. So I lived in DC for 7 years before I'm coming to here and like in Northern Virginia, it's like essentially DC more or less, but it yeah. has that same feeling of just pretty cookie cutter like
what's
apartment
that like
buildings.
Beautiful town in Virginia like right across from DC. I think it starts with is it Arlington?
Alexandria is more beautiful. I feel like Alexandria has also more like history.
Alexandria, I like walk around there, I'm like, well, this is a perfect American city.
It is. And I think
I've never been.
Yeah, it's
just architecturally it's all like 1700s
it.
Like brick townhouses. It's really lovely.
Yeah,
will you take me sometime?
Yeah. Yeah, let's go to Virginia.
I
want to
go. I love that. So her life here, though, growing up, she really did bounce around a lot within one section. Do you know what
yeah,
I mean? Like, I
right.
feel like she moved a lot, but from one part of Brooklyn to another and then to Long Island and then like to different parts of Brooklyn again. So, but it must have felt very hectic.
And she said she moved 13 times. She would yeah. move 13. That's so... It sounds so traumatizing as a
yes.
child.
Yeah.
Right.
Especially because, I mean, and it's so sad to think that they started in a place where she feels she could have been accepted for being a mixed race family. And instead they moved to Long Island, which I would say to this day is a very racist, like outward.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
And not just racist, like we're all racist, but like racist in that they're like proud of it. Racist.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
they moved
yeah.
to a very
I
racist
see.
Area.
Yeah.
There's something else she said that struck me in relation.
I was gonna say.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say they moved to a very racist, but like also classist area where they like didn't have a lot of money,
right.
and so then she was like living in this like shack without clothes and shoes
yeah,
and
that
things.
Was really sad.
So she was like not only everything about her was something that was like not accepted where they were.
Right, and that one line that she says about how people made fun of how she would cycle through like a few like three shirts or something
yeah.
was so.
It's just so sad.
Tragic. And something she said in this book really strikes me, which is that I think maybe this was still in her earlier home in Brooklyn Heights, but it was the idea that her mother, her white mother, would walk, like the idea of her walking ahead of the mixed kids and black father to secure safety. to like ensure security. Yes. Like, what would that mean for a black father?
Yeah, the masculine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think.
Yeah, it's like kind of emasculating.
I was kind of shocked at like the honesty and insightfulness she had in the masculinity dynamic between her brother and her father, and the fact that that was such a like a toxic dynamic yeah. between them, and that they're both constantly trying to assert their dominance.
Wait, yeah. can I ask you a question? Was your sense that the my sense taking from what I read was like the brother was more of a toxic figure than her father? What was your impression?
So I have a pretty strong impression of I feel like a lot of daughters do this where they are much harder on their mother than they are on their dad. I feel like because her dad died before the book was written, it was easier for her to forgive him. I think because so much of her identity to me, like reading the book, was wrapped up in having her black side not be respected and like understood in her childhood. And she blamed that on her mom a lot, that she was able to forgive her father's like trespasses because she understood that so much of it came out of this pain he experienced from like growing up in like such a racist world. And she was very forgiving. I mean, even I think Ashley even said, she was like, well, the dad didn't do that much except for abandon them. And I'm like, well, and he was physically abusive.
I always forget.
But like, I do think that that's not a mistake that you forget that. I do feel like it's very quietly written in there. And she's like, he never did anything to me because by the time he moved out, I was still only two or three. But she does very kind of like quietly tuck her dad's problems away and talk about how much she admired and loved him for, but he did kind of abandon her hardcore.
Right,
they had one weekly meetup, and
that he stopped showing up for.
And he, you know what I mean, beat up the brother. Like, she talks about the police being called on their physical fight.
Wait, you know what just happened with me? What you said is like shedding light on is that, that whole fight that she describes was like 12 cops and the brother and the father. Somehow I wasn't even processing the dad's contribution to that. I was like, whoa, was the brother like really angsty and couldn't process his feelings?
Yeah, she is so kind. She's very easy on the father in the book, the way it's written.
Totally. And I like forgot.
Yeah, I do think we all fell for like, and I don't think she even consciously knows she's doing it, but I do think one, it's because she relates so hard to her father because she feels that like her black half was not expressed or recognized the way she needed it to be. And in that sense, she really gives a lot of credence to that. And then also, I do think because he's dead, it's easier
to
and be forgiving. And because he died before her major, she talks a little bit about their relationship after her success. But, you know, the way the brother like was trying to execute murder plots with blackmail, like, I don't think the
black. At first I was like with blackmail, but then I realized M-A-I-L.
The brother was trying to blackmail her.
Very tricky. We're talking about black men and then blackmail.
He used regular mail to get in touch. USPS, save the USPS. Anyway. But I think that the way I also think, again, it's easier to forgive someone when they're dead, but it's also easier to forgive the fact he wasn't around for the stuff that like could have been extra controversial. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. As she got older.
Yeah.
And I think even my reaction to it comes like, I don't have a brother and I have like a very present, supportive black father, despite his own relationship with like my grandfather who I've never met. So I feel like that totally shaped my reaction to this thing, this dynamic, which is
totally.
Like, I don't have a like older brother. Like, oh my God, that sounds scary and weird that he was like mean. And then and then I'm like being, I also feel sympathetic towards the dad. But then, so then this other thing that she mentioned, which is an extremely heartbreaking moment, was that, you know, that thing where it's like she had a friend, her mom picked up a friend for like a play date.
Yeah.
And the friend burst into tears when she saw the dad. That was so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that one thing that like really struck me, like one thing that I think was really hard for her about being mixed is that she was very white passing. And so then people who were taught to be racist didn't know to be racist to her until they met her dad. And then like she would watch that realization like happen in people's eyes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Which has got to be really harrowing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that stuff happened a lot too when I was a kid. But the thing is that I was in Japan and like just don't think I was that perceptive or I have... to that, you know, because I don't think I was like so I was just like la la la, I'm a kid, and I don't think that I was so aware of like the racism that my dad experienced, but he talks about it more like as I got older. And I have one random memory of like him like obviously for like obvious historical reasons Japan does not have the same civil rights laws that the US does because we didn't have Japan didn't have like black chattel labor.
Heads up.
So it's can be weird because then sometimes like independent vendors won't sell to foreigners or like whatever. And I remember that happened once to my dad, but I don't think I like really. I that's the thing that struck me. It was like her talking about seeing her dad experience racism and like really feel it. Is like I was like, oh, I think I must have experienced that a bunch as a child, but I don't know if I really processed it. And it's like here I was like, I think
I obviously have literally no idea, but I wonder if it's because you did have your dad was, you said, a warm and supportive
and
person.
So supportive.
Do you know
what I
mean?
Yeah.
I think that having a loving family, it's probably easier to be like, life is good. Whereas if you're living her life where like everything is constantly a fight, and then you're out in the world and people are mad at you and mad at your dad and racist towards your dad. I think that if he had constantly been at home being like, everything sucks, then you would have gone out in the world and seen what sucks.
Right. I literally used to do a joke about how I know I've had an easy life because I can't remember any of it. I'm like, do you know what I mean? Like, and I literally think about memoirs like this where I'm just like, oh my God, she's like talking about every minute of her childhood.
About, like, the pasta.
And I'm like, did I even have a childhood? Like, I can't remember any of it. And I'm like, that's how I know it wasn't harrowing, because none of it harrowed me.
Wait, that's really funny and real. Exactly. I have associations of Mariah with my childhood, but it's like
positive ones. Yeah.
Positive. Yeah. And I don't remember much else. But then wait. Okay. Two things occurred to me, which one's related to the pasta scene. One's related to the I'm trying to like. Oh, OK. More broadly, it's like what's really elucidating about this book is that it's like I don't think as a little brown child that I ever thought about Mariah as like a black or brown person in me, like a, you know, when you talk about representation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think Mariah ever filled that exactly for me in a way that I like made sense. Like, I was like,
I didn't know until this book that she was black. I know that's, I feel like that's going to be really funny, but I didn't know a lot about her. I barely knew all the songs that turned out to be hers. I was like, I didn't know that was a Mariah Carey song. So I didn't know much about her. And I was really shocked when I went to buy this book that it was under, it's literally in Amazon as Black American Memoirs. And I was like, first of all, I didn't know she was black. Then I was like, it's interesting to me that they'd put it here instead of under a celebrity memoir. But now that I read it, I'm like, oh, it's because it's not a celebrity memoir.
It's about
it
race
is a celebrity. It's, I mean, it's a memoir about, race and family in America.
That's so true, which is actually a really interesting surprise with this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a little bit all over the place, but you mentioned that pasta scene with her grandmother, how she ruined it with Kraft Parmesan cheese. But you know, okay, this is my thing, is that like the description of asking for a snack and getting like a Ritz cracker actually just made me so interested. I just like really wanted Ritz crackers. She really painted this like visceral experience of anticipating this.
Well,
see,
even
treat.
That I think is such an interesting story of how her relationship with her father versus her relationship with her mother. So in this story, she would say she was hungry. She was 6 years old. They got like a meal a day at his house, which was this meal that he would slave over. I probably shouldn't say that.
Right.
No, but he would like spend all day cooking this pasta. It was like a labor of love.
Right.
But he was in the kitchen all day working on this pasta, and she would like say, could I have a snack? A lot of 6-year-olds want snacks. And she would get a Ritz cracker. And she talks about like nibbling on the sides and like savoring it. But also that's very, like, that's described almost as a testament to his discipline and his ability.
Yes.
Like, and she's like almost grateful for that Ritz cracker. And like, isn't this a cute, quaint story? Whereas I do believe if that story had been her mom's story, it would have then been an example of the scarcity and
you're right.
Negligence.
I think that's true too. Right.
And I think it's like all three. I really do feel like daughters have a hard time truly vilifying their fathers because I think then I think it's the other layers.
And I also do think it's just also definitely like a symptom of the way that we view parental roles.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's always, you know, when people say like dad is babysitting his own kid, you know what I mean? It's like when a dad is just around, the fact that he was making them this elaborate meal and like had a Ritz cracker to hand her is amazing work.
Yeah.
Like how impressive, he could make pasta.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas the mom is expected to like really anticipate and care for a child's needs at every second. And Yeah.
It's like that. It reminds me, makes me think of that like trope in just like general commercials on TV where if it's like a dad serving their kid Cheerios, you're like, wow.
Yeah.
Masculinity has evolved.
We are so lucky to have a man that doesn't expect his children to starve.
Right. And so I think definitely that plays into like anybody's like reaction to that. And I also, and then also relates to that thing she describes where like, the dad, oh, she wants ice cream from an ice cream truck. And he's like, okay, he like gets really serious about the language she uses. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Are you borrowing it or are you, do you want it? And it's like, actually reading this, I was like, I'm sure there's a universe in which, like whether or not this is even true, it's like the idea is that if she said I'd want it, maybe he would have just given it to her.
Yeah.
But he was being like really intentional about her language and like expected her to pay her back. It's like, because he's a man, I think, maybe as the reader is more inclined to be like, wow, what an interesting, what's the word? Like responsibility teaching or like financial education.
Yeah. No, and I do think it's interesting, but I think it is like her truth. I think this, the childhood at least segment of the book was a very honest depiction of how she feels her childhood.
Yeah. And I do think that there are things, I mean, obviously there's things to fault her mother for, but like, I don't know. Maybe it is just because I was reading this book like truly from falling into the way she was writing it, because I was so mad at the mom after I finished this book. Like it really fucked me up. That scene where she's talking about like eating that hot dog when her hair looked nice. The fact that she like had a mom who had mixed kids who never learned a thing about black hair. Like really.
I think that's really sad.
Yeah. I was like, this is not progressive for her. Just the fact that she like fell in love with a person of a different race. The fact that she like didn't acknowledge that her kid need a comb is really fucked up to me.
That was so striking, actually, because I feel like probably there were, I think it seems like there was a lot of that too among mixed people from that generation.
Yeah.
I think now there's like more awareness, or like actually there's like, I feel like there's like concretely more resources for white parents.
Literally
of a mixed
YouTube.
Kid. Literally YouTube. And there's like so much of it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And yeah, that scene where she like talks about her aunts kind of getting into her, like trying to do it, and then it doesn't really work because her hair isn't the same texture as theirs.
Right.
It was like, whew, that was like, yeah, really, it like really struck a, actually just like a chord with me, but also like, maybe not because I have a white mother who didn't know anything about it. That's not the case. It's just kind of like her trying to like figure out her identity in relation to race, and then like she didn't get to be part of this like one category that made sense, which is like little black girl. Like she didn't
or and I think the alienation from her siblings, it was very interesting in that they did not believe that she also had a hard time. And that because what she was experiencing was unique to her and different than her siblings, she really was like an island.
Yeah.
And I think that was like its own trauma, was the fact that she didn't have an experience that was relatable to the people she knew.
Right.
Yeah.
And like why it was so important that she met Derek Jeter. I feel like we talk about Nick Cannon being her sexual awakening. And I was like, I almost think that Derek Jeter was like her racial awakening.
Her racial
I think, she like never met anyone who had a similar experience to her until she was like, what, 28 and met Derek Jeter. Like, that's crazy.
Which is really crazy. It's so hard to fathom. But I think that happened maybe in general with a lot of people that are her age.
Yes.
And they're mixed.
And also her experience was, I talk a lot about how she went straight from her mom's house to her husband, Tommy Mottola's house.
Right.
And so she went from her white mother's house to then like her white mother who didn't really let her express herself house to Tommy Mottola who didn't really let her express herself house. And so maybe they were around. There were people for her to meet and relate to, but she wasn't allowed.
She wasn't allowed and didn't get to engage that in any way.
Yeah, like if she had just had in early 20s living in downtown New York, she probably would have had that awakening. Like she would have met people sooner.
Yeah, totally.
I guess like the way you said earlier that you're like, well, I had a great dad and like I had a great childhood.
Right.
And she was like, when I met Derek Jeter, I think she literally said, she was like, oh, the problem in my family wasn't just because we were like an interracial family. It was my family was the problem.
Right.
And it was important for her to learn that. But
yeah,
I had no real sense that Mariah had a difficult family. Although the other thing that occurs to me now is like maybe with like really uniquely talented people like Mariah, there's like, it's a given that somehow something was going on in their family background.
I mean, I will say reading all these memoirs for celebrities, I'm like, well, I don't know that I'll be successful because I really grew up in one. Like, I had one home mostly. And that seems like a precursor.
So funny and so dark.
But it's true. But it's like there is, like, how do you have a drive like that? I mean, it is.
I'll tell you what. if we don't make it, it's our parents' fault. They loved us like idiots.
Yeah, it's something where it's like, I mean, how do you want something that badly? Like, I think at the end of the day, I guess I just don't want it badly enough.
Yeah.
They didn't think about our futures.
Well, not for a second. And yeah, it is that thing where like she, I had no idea that it was that bad or that it was bad at all. Honestly, I didn't know much about her. Yeah. Also, and I think that it's because she had this like trauma all throughout her life. Cause like she obviously was always disappearing into her own little like fantasy world, right, as like often is a symptom of trauma. And so now she like writes these, literally the song Fantasy, but like all of these songs are like, she creates this like perfect depiction of like whatever emotion she like wants to be feeling because she knows how to like manifest it instead of just literally feel it.
Yeah. It's like she's an actress in her brain. She's been able to like create.
Which is like weird that then she wasn't a good actress.
Yeah. Which actually, okay, that scene with the cheese where her grandmother, like her dad makes this, you know, pasta dish that's like really elegant with like the clams.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then the her grandmother like puts this like processed Parmesan cheese on it and she screams like no and like runs away. It was hard for me to actually even believe that as the reader.
Same. I was had like, a hard what? Time with that story. Yeah.
That's so funny. That's literally the story. Ashley was like, I don't think this is a cute story.
No, it's actually just kind of annoying and I don't really get it because it's like most kids just like shitty cheese.
Yeah. I like did not understand it, and also I like don't understand anything about Italian food, and so like back that they like put, she's like, you never do that. You never put Parmesan cheese on seafood pasta. And someone else, I said something, was it you who said that? That you
no,
never,
Mateo
was like, how'd you, Mateo Lane was like, you would never put Parmesan cheese on seafood pasta. And I was like, this is the first I'm hearing of
Wait,
this.
What was Mateo's reaction to that scene? Did he like,
he loved that scene because he liked a lot that there was like a weird Italian undercurrent.
Oh,
like where she couldn't express her black self, she was allowed to be Italian.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was saying it's interesting because the dad made Italian food, and then she talks about, of course, being on Long Island, and the first time she felt accepted with the hair situation was with the Guidettes.
Which makes sense
because they have very thick hair.
Yeah.
Which was funny because, so my mom has really, really thick curly hair.
Where's your mom from?
She's just like an Irish girl.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
But she has very thick hair, and it has like a lot of texture to it. And when I was younger, mine was much more textured. And I like had such hair struggles growing up. And I will say, my mom, I grew up like watching her do like the wackiest shit to her.
to
try to just tame it. And I don't know if it's because she didn't know she should be using black products. That's something I know for sure now.
Yeah.
But I like have this memory of like being six and watching her put a contact lens solution in her hair and just like,
what?
Why?
That seems so bad for your hair.
But it was like, she didn't know what to, I don't know. She was just like, you just got to get it down. And so I was little with like this super thick hair and I never knew what to do with it either. And I also had a mom who didn't know what to do with it either.
Isn't that just like alcohol? What's in contact solution?
I think it would really dry the fuck out of
your
hair.
I would dry your hair like no matter what the texture was.
But her method was like, whatever's on hand, you just put it in. And the thing is we both, I mean, her hair is like three times as thick as mine, but it's like her hair is so thick it just absorbed anything. I mean, she could put full just like olive oil in her hair and you wouldn't even know. And so she was just like
smoothing it out with Crisco.
And so I've always personally related that blonde long Blake Lively bullshit is like a myth.
I will say it is like this weird thing that like has only come into my conscience, like maybe I'm just too stupid, but like I really would see people on TV and be like, they just have beautiful hair and I have stupid frizzy hair. Like I've since started getting like keratin treatments and stuff.
Oh yeah.
I literally was just like, I just have hair that sucks and everyone else has hair that's good. And then I like found out about extensions. Like it never occurred to me that, I thought extensions were to just make your hair longer. Like I didn't know that it made it thick and
fuller,
luscious and beautiful.
Whatever. Yeah.
I just thought extensions, if you have short hair but you want long hair, you extension it.
It's wild how pervasive then like beauty standards about hair are in just like across different pockets of society.
Yeah.
And I think even like, okay, here's my thing too about Mariah is like, I feel like in even on her Christmas album, she has curlier hair. I think she like presents as someone with curlier hair, right?
Yeah.
I would say probably for more than the past decade. I love how she like loves her older woman body and it's like really beautiful and curvy, but like she have a Maybe it was also just that style, like the TRL time was like bone straight hair. So I think I just had no sense of how she was black. Cause
her hair is like a little bit lighter too.
It is anyway. It's and blonde, finer naturally, I think. So, right.
And so, yeah. And she also talks about the way she would do her hair is because specifically her record label and Tommy Mottola wanted her to look like
Italian, I think.
Italian, because they didn't want her to be presented as black. Like and so I think that that's why, like, as a business investment and a husband, he was basically just like, don't talk about your life. I don't care.
Right.
And so then I think, like, after she left Sony is when she, like, started being able to, like, figure out how she wanted to be.
To and present herself.
Yeah.
Which is, so I think now, if young Mariah came out with like whatever hair texture she wanted, it would just be eaten up.
It would light up the scene.
It would
it's
really.
It's so funny to me think that, like, I was so embarrassed I didn't realize she was black until now you're saying, but it's like, no, it's not our fault. We were fed, literally, it was on purpose. It was by design that hid it.
No, it was like literally she talks about how they said, there's like a passage in the book where they say if she straightened her hair, it made it look forcefully straightened. And if she wore it naturally, it looked like natural hair. And so then they would wave her hair so that it looked Italian.
Which is like doubly manufactured for society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we can't. God. The layers to that. I mean, the layers to that haircut. Not
the layers to her layers.
That's like an essay.
Layers of Mariah's layers. My God.
Yeah.
Okay, do you have any final thoughts? Like your impressions? Oh. Of Mariah post reading.
Also, if you want to keep talking about it, we can. I just don't. We don't want to like take.
Oh no! I think, and I mentioned this a little bit before we started talking for the podcast, is that I definitely was intrigued and surprised by actually how thoughtful it was, or like how frankly of race this book is. Like, I didn't expect that.
Right? Yeah.
And I really actually enjoyed for the readers at home, the visual part of it, which is those photographs. I really liked it. There's like a section in the book where there's just like old photos. What I loved about it, and she has photos of her black grandmother and her dad and her mom.
It's beautiful. Her husband, so I mean, her dad.
Yeah.
I'm like, gorgeous. He's really so handsome. Pretty.
I really like them because I think they help me contextualize her as a young person.
Yes.
And she's really cute, and you like see her childhood. You can kind of like see, like, there's like this like one photograph, it's labeled me with the late Bohemian Pat, who is her mother. And so it's this like tall white woman with like long dark hair who's holding young Mariah, who looks like 3 or 4, on a swing, and she has like kind of frizzy hair, and like you can imagine her as this like little what's the word? Kind of like sprightly, whimsical child.
Yeah, that, like a scampering youth.
Scampering youth, totally. She has like deep scampering youth energy, which actually kind of, which comes through in her Touch My Body music video.
Yeah.
To bring it back
really
around.
It really does.
I really am. So we've talked about, this is probably fucked up, but I have a theory that she has been sexually assaulted more than she like lets on in this book. In this book, she kind of acts like she isn't. But if you look at her sexual relationships, they don't really add up to us. And Ashley brought up the really good point that it's interesting she was writing all these love songs.
It was Tommy and stuff. Yeah.
She was never in love. And so I do think it's interesting when you talk about like whimsical and scampering, and like she has such a deep creativity in her to have created, I would almost call them dioramas of emotion in song. And the way. Like, thank you. I was thinking about that earlier and I really wanted to get it in here. But it's like with the songs, between the lyrics and the production and the fact that she's like writing all of it in the way with her voice as an instrument to be able to create just these little like encapsulments of emotions that she hasn't necessarily experienced firsthand is so incredible. Mm-hmm. With like the meticulous detail that she's able to, I mean, that she had one good Christmas, and look at the way she's literally changed Christmas.
She actually really did.
Yeah.
Like that's an unbelievable power to have, to be
incredible.
Able to take, to have just like a whiff of an emotional experience and be able to just understand it and recreate it and like, and put it on people.
That first vocalization she does in All I Want for Christmas. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like, you're like, it like fills your body. You're like, oh fuck, it's Christmas.
Nipples get hard. You're so excited.
Over. Yeah. It's November 1st.
I mean,
I was so impressed. It's so funny because somebody at work, I was telling them about this book and how incredible it is and how I never gave her credit for being the songwriter she is. I just didn't know.
Right.
And I was like, she writes all her own songs. And this woman at work goes, well, not the Christmas one. And I was like, no, the Christmas one.
Right. Everything.
It's so hard to believe. And I saw her even speak about it. And she says, a lot of people assume I didn't write that because it sounds so nostalgic and it sounds like a remake of a classic. But she goes, I wrote it to sound like a classic. That's, and I'm like, yeah, God damn it, bitch. You're a genius.
She is a genius.
Wow.
It's more to say than that. She's just a fucking genius. And I'm like, God bless that she got out of that.
I'm so glad.
I think Matteo Lane said it. And he said, it's just so heartbreaking to see what she experienced as a child and to know that she would go on to bring so much happiness to people. And I feel like that's such like a sappy thing to say. But I mean, when you tell that story about being four and remember dancing with your parents, it's insane that it's true.
It's true.
She brought so much happiness to people with her music.
Oh my God.
It's true. So true. Like, I swear to God, my parents still have, you know, they have some structure somewhere in the living room where they have CDs that they never use anymore. But it's like, there's the Mariah Carey Christmas CD in my parents' house that's like kind of cracked, but it's the one that was around.
Yeah.
My God. Yeah.
Well, this was a really,
this is such a perfect end to our Mariah chapter. Oh,
thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming.
This was amazing.
Oh.
Do you want to plug anything? Do you have anything coming up? I realize we never ask people to plug stuff anymore. And that's why we don't know how it ended.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's also weird.
Comedically Zoom shows.
I have a set coming out on Comedy Central, but I think that they're not airing it until February. So for the moment, I'll just plug my Instagram, I guess, where I post about upcoming shows in the cold or online. It's Brittany, Brittany_carnivore. Brittany_carnivore.
Are you a carnivore?
I am a carnivore, but I grew up in a vegetarian household.
That's so interesting.
I'm also a carnivore. But also, I was going to say, if you follow her there, you'll know about the Comedy Central side.
It was like kind of interesting learning about how comedy productions of that kind are played out right now because it was like COVID compliant.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You did it during the COVID.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Wow. You're so good at comedy that you're getting booked in a pandemic. I mean, when I say that we bring the best of the best to you guys on this podcast, people were literally risking death to hear her jokes. And we're bringing it to you in the safety of your car, probably.
Yeah, or your house, or your dog walking
experience.
So
thanks for having me, guys.
Enjoy that.
Thank you so much for coming.
Tell your dog I say hi. Bye, guys.